More nothing. What the hell? Ian jerked the trigger twice. Click, snap. Nothing. Click, snap. Nothing one more time. God damn it. Quick, he broke the shotgun down. Loaded. Two shells in the barrels. Firing pin sharp and striking. Then what the hell is the problem? Shotgun back up under his chin. Evolution. Art. Immortality. Click. Snap. Fucking shit. What the fuck? God fucking damn it. Out from under his chin, Ian shook the shotgun, rattled it, jerked the trigger, jerked the trigger. The sun moving well up into the sky. The sounds of people and commuters and shadow traffic copters all swirling together to spoil a glorious moment. It was do or die time. Die or live time. Click, snap. Ah, Jesus. Shaking and jerking and swinging the shotgun. What does a guy gotta do to kill himself? What the hell does a guy gotta... Like a pair of lions, the shotgun barrels roared. Buckshot tore away Ian's right foot, leaving a shredded pulp of knotted bone and blood-sloshing flesh. Oh, shit! The shotgun flew from Ian's hand, and up into them jumped the bloody, meat-dripping stump of a foot broiling with a pain so severe and intense that truly, Ian felt nothing at all. It was the idea of having a foot shotgun blast amputated into a useless half-mass that caused him hurt. Oh, Christ! Oh, fucking Christ! Clutching his foot, Ian did a one-legged cartoon hop, something Larry might do after Moe dropped a bowling ball on his toes, that did nothing to dissipate the mounting agony. What it did do was cause him to lose his balance, send him tumbling against the beautiful and recently installed frameless all-glass balcony doors, the crash of his body into the glass more than slightly drowned out by the sound of shards embedding, ripping, and tearing human flesh. Ah, Jesus, Jesus, shit! Like some fucked-up acupuncture, the glass skewering his back quite effectively redirected Ian's thoughts from his missing foot. More hopping around now, but with some contorted groping, Ian trying to pull the pieces of the door from his back, hopping, writhing, reaching, screaming. The floor of the deck slick with blood, a hop and a slip, a skid, a thigh hitting the balcony railing, and a body flipping into the open, empty air. Empty, except for the sound of the girl-like screech Ian let out as he piloted for the ground. Had he not done that, had he not opened his mouth to scream, he might have survived the fall onto the bags of soft, moist fertilizer the landscapers had piled beneath the balcony. Instead, the impact forced the fertilizer down his throat, into his lungs, bloating and choking them with manure. At the same time, a cloud of refined Milo granite shot up into the air, settled over Ian's body like a burial shroud. A very stinky burial shroud. The door had opened, and he had stumbled and tripped and fallen through it to immortality. This was the last of Ian. Buddy flipped his back to the east and jammed up his hands against his face to keep the sunlight out of his eyes. He didn't want the light. He didn't want to see what the day had in store for him. For sure, he didn't want to peek in the back seat of the Continental. But he did. He took his hands down and turned and looked on the off chance that everything that had happened the night before hadn't happened. Buddy had heard the phrase, pool of blood, get tagged with bodies that had been shot up or stabbed and allowed to slow die. But that's all it was, a phrase. Hyperbole, Buddy would have called it if Buddy knew what hyperbole meant. And yet, there in the back seat, Alfonso's drained, pale body floated in a real, live, honest-to-God pool of blood. Buddy went back to jamming his hands to his face, But a couple of minutes of that, and he came up with the notion all covering his eyes would do was keep him from seeing the cops when they showed up. And they would show up. Cops got a thing for murder. And drug-related mayhem? They positively loved that. So Buddy got himself together as best he could and got out of the car. That didn't amount to much. It didn't at all improve the situation. But getting out of the Continental was more than he'd been able to manage for the last 5 hours. Beyond that, he hadn't worked out a plan of action. So Buddy settled for standing around like a dumbass with a stiff in his ride. That he could handle just fine. On the overpass above him, the morning traffic zipped along, slower and slower as the road filled up with Angelenos off to day labor. Below the overpass, around him, was a small graveyard of abandoned cars. Other people discarding the trouble in their lives? A dog lay near a concrete support. It was sleeping, or dead. The flies that buzzed around it said dead. In the time it took Buddy to analyze his surroundings, he was able to stitch together another piece of the plan he was forming moment by moment. He would check on Alfonso. Appearances to the contrary, there was the possibility that somehow Alfonso had been able to survive the bullets and the bleeding and was still... Buddy opened the back door. Alfonso moved like he was trying to get out of the car without using his legs. His torso kept leaning until it wasn't leaning. It was falling. The body kept falling until its head stopped it by smacking the pavement hard. Same as if Alf was trying to drive nails with his skull. The accompanying thud was just as loud. Buddy took that as confirmation, along with the bullet holes and that pool of blood that, yeah, Alfonso was, in fact, dead. Buddy stared at Alfonso some. When he finished that, he delivered a eulogy to his extinct pal.
"You son of a bitch! I told you not to die on me! I told you not to die!"
Buddy blessed the body a few times with kicks to its chest and head. The carcass resonated spastically at the end of each blow.
"Now what am I supposed to do? What the hell am I supposed to do now?"
The final benediction, very quietly.
"I told you not to die."
The body's hand moved. A last twitch caused by the firing of a dying axon, or the tightening of muscles as they went into rigor. Or maybe it was just one more spasm left over from Buddy's flailing foot. Buddy looked at it, the hand, and what it clutched. A package wrapped in brown paper. A brick of heroin. As freaked out as Buddy was, he wasn't so freaked out that the sight of the dope couldn't slap him steady. Couldn't get his brain working proper. Take the dope. Sell the dope. Take the money. Get hidden. Stay hidden. Maybe he was the last man standing in a drug murder fiasco, but L.A. churned those out every hour on the hour. It wouldn't be long until people forgot which drug murder fiasco in particular Buddy was wanted for, and stopped caring if he ever took a tumble for it or not. But until then... Quick, Buddy reached down and grabbed the package. Hard, he yanked on it, trying to pull it free of Alf's rock-solid death grip. Foot to the body's chest for leverage, one more stiff tug. The package came loose. The body skipped backward. Buddy, a demon of the night, trying to outdistance the sun, ran. The sun did its goddamnedest to punch its light through the eastern windows of Chad's house. It didn't come close. Not even. The drapes he'd hung, the designs stolen from ones in the rooms at Caesar's in Vegas, were thick enough to keep out the light of an atomic blast. Chad dug the dark. The drapes, the ones he had, cost a little more than most drapes would have a nerve to. Anti-atomic blast drapes ain't cheap, but thanks to a little creative financing, Chad was able to afford them. Creative financing is what got him his house, too. 3,300 square feet. 3,300 square feet in the Palisades. Nothing but creative financing could get you a house like that in a part of town like this. Same with the car in Chad's driveway. BMW 750 IL. The big Beamer. Chad would have been much better off with the 5 Series. The 3 would have been fine. Even that Roadster was cute. But every D-girl in Hollywood drove one of those Roadsters, and kids who worked at the Gap somehow rated 3s. And there wasn't a Beverly Hills doctor or a Santa Monica lawyer who didn't roll in a 5. The 7s were the ones that set you apart from the crowd. The 7s were the ones that got you looked at right when you pulled up to Morton's or Orso. 7s were what the big boys at ICM, WMA, CAA, all the power 10-percenteries dominoed on Wilshire Chad aspired to ascend to from the mid-level boutique, not as respected agency status in which he currently found himself mired, rolled in. And if you want to be there, in that club, the society of big-dicked agents, then you got a front like you belong. So a 7 is what Chad wanted. And thanks again to creative financing, a 7 is what he got himself. The problem with creative financing is that making payments is a motherfucker. Not because the nut is particularly high. Not only because of that, but because it's got to be made on time. All the time. Got to be. Must be. Has to be. If anyone were to take a serious gander at things, if someone were to check a few facts and recheck a few figures, if anybody had enough snap, crackle, and pop to see that 2 and 2 wasn't adding up to 4, that was the other problem with creative financing. When you were sitting around minding your own business trying to relax and enjoy your creatively financed life, all of a sudden ideas would start to creep into your brain box about all the everythings that could go wrong at any moment. But there was Ian and Will of Instinct and the new album they were due to start recording that would probably ship at 2 million units, for starters. And a tour. Can't have a new album without a tour. And a Will of Instinct tour would sell out all of the 18 cities it was booked in. 23. Better make it 23 cities. And all that, the new album, and the tour, and some merchandising thrown in for good measure, all that would take care of any creative financing problems. And with all that cash-generating superpower of Will of Instinct squarely in his pocket, Chad rarely ever thought about all the everythings that could go so very wrong. Rarely ever. Except for every single quiet moment he was alone with himself. Chad went to a whole lot of trouble not to catch himself alone with his panicky thoughts. Instead, there were clients to hang with, parties to attend, aspiring songstresses to talk business with. Except for last night. Last night found Chad without a client or a party, or a chick who thought she could make it big in music if only she met the right people. So when he should have been sleeping, he was sitting up thinking. The phone rang. Rang him out of his closed loop of nervous notions, and Chad was thankful for it. "Hello?" he said, clear-headed from being so very awake. Marcus, who was on the other end of the line, was a bit surprised at Chad's alertness at the early hour, but was glad as the things to come would require much sharp thinking. Marcus said, "It's Ian." "That's all," Marcus said. All he needed to say. Chad knew. When you get a call first thing in the morning from one of your assistants about one of your volatile alternative rock star clients, and all your assistant says to you is, "It's Ian," you've got a pretty good idea of the craziness the day's about to bring. "Where?" Chad asked. "His house," Marcus answered. Chad hung up. Chad got up and went into his newly remodeled bathroom, and showered and shaved and dressed in an Armani suit, not being particular about which one. After that, he went down to his 750 IL and started it, and drove to Ian's house. Through all that, the showering and the dressing and the drive, Chad's little head was filled with nothing but very troubled thoughts on creative financing. Damon Evans was not trying to deal with any motherfucking sunshine. It was too goddamn late in the day for that. Early is what it was, but Damon hadn't crashed yet, so as far as he was concerned, it was late in the day. Too goddamn late in the day for sunshine. But the sun never minded Damon, and came on anyway, pouring light down on Baldwin Hills, on the big houses and fancy cars up in there. So big and so fancy you'd think you were in Beverly Hills, except you weren't. And you know it, 'cause Baldwin Hills is where the big houses and fancy cars are owned by blacks. African Americans. Call them what you want. They don't care. They're rich and they'll buy your ass if they don't like you. They were the smart blacks. The well-spoken blacks. The black executives and professionals, and some of them entertainment people, who'd gotten themselves all moneyed up, but instead of moving west where the rest of the L.A. money cribbed, they kept themselves close to their roots. They were keeping their shit real. That's what they'd tell you. They'd tell you they stayed in the hills to keep connected with where they were from. But what it was this. Living in Baldwin Hills made them feel good. It don't matter who you are, what color. It always feels good to be able to look down on where you came from. Down on all the suckers who didn't make it, couldn't make it, to up where you're at. That's what hills are for, aren't they? For looking down? Damon wasn't an executive or professional. Wasn't an entertainment big to do. He got his money the old-fashioned way. He sold drugs for it. And with his drug money, he got himself a big-ass house up in the hills. And the execs and pros and them didn't think much about how Damon paid for it. 'Cause Damon didn't sell around the neighborhood. And for all they knew, Damon was a rapper or some such something. That didn't make Damon happy, his bougie neighbors thinking he was a rapper. Why is a young brother with ends gotta be a rapper? Why couldn't he be a white-collar brother like them? Yeah, okay, he wasn't a white-collar brother. He was a crack dealer. And rapping is a big step up from selling. But he could have been an exec. Could have been. If he'd made it past the seventh grade. Damon wasn't happy about his neighbors not giving him props. He wasn't happy about the goddamn sunlight. There was a whole gang of shit Damon wasn't happy about. And Omar and Kenny knew it.
"One of y'all motherfuckers wanna school me on some shit?" Damon yelled.
It wasn't the yelling that hipped Omar and Kenny to Damon's pissedness. Damon was always going off on something. They knew he wasn't right because he was yelling about drugs, and when drugs were involved, Damon could get a serious mad on.
"So what the fuck is going down?" Damon yelled on.
"Omar.
Don't know. Don't know? What the fuck you doing on my dime when you don't be knowing shit? I can get bitches for free that don't know shit."
Omar didn't say anything to that, not right away. And neither did Kenny, who never had a whole lot to say for himself. Kenny didn't like to talk, because he didn't like the sound of his voice. It didn't sound good, courtesy of a bullet in the throat at age 6, caught one night while he was sitting at the dinner table. Bullet right through the wall, right through his throat. Half of a part of an inch to the left, and the slug would have snapped his spine. Killed him. He was lucky, is what he got told. Yeah. What a lucky motherfucker Kenny was to take a bullet in the throat between spoonfuls of generic peas and government cheese, which was just about all his family could afford on aid. It left Kenny with a gurgle of a rasp that he blames for slowing up his sex life. He didn't get laid a first time until he was 13, 4 years ago. So with all that working for him, Kenny wasn't a talker. He was good with his nines, though. Three dead motherfuckers will tell you all about that. Omar was still taking a moment to not respond to Damon. He looked over at the two skeezers on the couch, bookending his boss. There were always two of them on the couch. At least two. And Omar thought them skeezers because that's what they were. Money girls. Like flies on Damon's green, spendable shit. Were they any more honorable of women, Omar would have acknowledged such. Omar had much love for women, having been raised in a house with three of them. His sister, his mother, who was only 15 years older than his sister, and his grandmother, who was just 22 years older than his mother. Three strong sisters getting by on their own. Yeah, Omar gave women their props, but these two on the couch, like the two who occupied their space the day before, and the others who had done the same days before that, were hoes and nothing but. Good looking, though. One was, the light-skinned one. The other one was not entirely ugly, and both had asses that were full and tight and worth having them around for. Damon, Omar gave up, had done very well for himself, moving from clocker to pusher. There was one time Omar knew of, Damon got bitch-slapped by another seller, and the seller got six caps for his trouble. Round this part of the world, props came from the end of a gun, and Damon had bought himself six bullets worth. So he quit selling and started supplying, and carved more territory and bought more lead-lined respect along the way, and it wasn't long before he had broke himself off a bunch of space just north of Torrance. Yeah, Damon was a regular captain of motherfucking industry. It wasn't much after that, he turned 20. 20 and a stone killer. And it showed. Young and young-looking, there wasn't anything youthful about Damon. The light in his eyes was a cold one. The blood in his veins was like battery acid. His innocence? That got buried right next to the first person he ever murdered. Somewhere in Los Angeles, there was a potter's field of interred young souls. A generation first neglected, then shoveled into a mass grave. Omar stopped thinking, stopped looking at the high yeller's ass, and got back to talking. Bentley and them went to take the shit over to Martin's. We didn't ever hear back. Bentley best not have run off with my shit. They ain't fools. No way they'd play you like that. Martin probably shooting this shit up. Goddamn powder cost me a grip. What the fuck do I let him move my shit for anyhow? Ain't nothing but a crackhead. He your cuz, Kenny pointed out, sounding like he was talking through a foot of gravel. That's what's fucked up about having a family. They always wanting to be breaking off some of your shit. Goddamn junkie. Every other motherfucking town dying off that shit, and Martin keeps going like that shit is spinach to him or something. No ceremony. Damon reached over and grabbed the girl's tit. Not high yellers, but the darker ones. Damon rubbed it, squeezed it, fondled it. The girl didn't do nothing about it. Nothing meaning nothing. She didn't try to stop him, and she didn't enjoy it. She just let her tit get grabbed, 'cause she knew, far as Damon cared, that was her sole reason for living. The action of the rubbing and the squeezing and the fondling seemed to have a calming effect on Damon. A race memory activated, telling him that the tit was the source of life and nourishment. It was a pacifier. That, and it made him think not so much about his missing drugs and more about having sex. Damon. Do work. Get your asses over there. Find my shit. marching orders. As always, without question, without hesitation, without thought, Omar and Kenny started marching. As they got to Stepan, they heard, in the middle of her tit massage, the dark girl saying,
"Oh, baby, I wants you bad. Let's get some buck wildin' on."
She said it just about like she meant it. Ian was still stretched out where he had left himself, on and with a throatful of the manure pile. The only changes of significance were that he was substantially more dead than previously, and that Chad was now present to view the body along with his assistants, Marcus, the assistant who had phoned up with the dead Ian news, and Jay, the other assistant. Chad referred to them respectively as the Black One and the Cherubic One. Cherubic in body and reddish cherubic in face. Usually Chad substituted the word cherubic with fat. Early on, when Chad lay around jerking off to fantasies about his big-time Hollywood agent career, he never envisioned himself with a male assistant, let alone two of them. Traditionally, male underlings were reserved for females and gay males. What real man would ever have anything other than a chick taking his dictation? But in the PC-ified world Chad found himself living in, having a couple of guys working for him was a safe bet. All it took was one duty bug in a skirt conjuring up a story involving some dirty joke, salacious look, or untoward move, then running down the halls of the company screaming like a bitch who ended up on the bad end of a back-alley gangbang, for all of Chad's career dreams to come crashing down around him. Worse, all it took was one femme assistant to get past her shock and over her fear of being blackballed from Hollywood forever, and report one of Chad's actual dirty jokes, salacious looks, or untoward moves, for Chad to get kicked to the Wilshire curb. So a couple of boys in the outer office it was. Chad made a quiet sound. A wisp of breath hiccuped from him, as if his body was working its way up to the release of his sorrow.
"Ian, Ian, Ian."
The mantra. Then came the grief. It came and came hard, but it was not for Ian. The sorrow Chad felt was for himself. For Ian, there was only rage.
"You stupid son of a bitch. You had to die."
Jay shuffled nervously. Marcus just stood. Down to the body, grabbing it by its tangle of hair, Chad yanked up the head. Air was expelled from its chest, clearing the lungs of a good portion of the fertilizer that filled them. Again with the yelling.
"You had to fucking die, didn't you?"
"Time to check out. It's time to check out." Hands folded before him, head down slightly, Marcus was a preacher delivering a sermon of the obvious. Chad spewed.
"It was not time for Ian to check out."
Chad dropped Ian's head. More manure dribbled from the mouth.
"Not when Will of Instinct owed the label another album. They were supposed to put out one more album. We had a contract, for Christ's sake. We had a contract, and this little fuck broke it."
Chad gave a kick to the body, as if, despite its shot-off foot, the razors of glass stuck in its back, the fall that forced it full of processed shit, the body hadn't done its fair share of suffering in passing, and was now taking collection on the balance. Jay kept up his shuffling, stared down intently at his feet to make certain they did the job correctly.
"Well, Will of Instinct can still put out a new..." "Will of Instinct? That's Will of Instinct right there, lying face down in a pile of crap."
Chad, for the record, indicated he was talking about Ian with another swipe of his foot. This morning in Los Angeles, there was a whole lot of dead body kicking going on. Chad.
"He wrote the songs. He sang the songs.
Nobody gives a good goddamn about the rest of those long-haired faggots. A mild spike from Jay, a little body jerk, before he went back to the studious business of shuffling some more. Chad to the body. One fucking album. Then for all I care, they could find you buck naked in a ditch with a needle in your arm. Hands still folded, heads still bowed, Marcus asked, "What do you want us to do?" "What?" Chad asked back. He was looking at Ian, but thinking of creative financing. "About Ian. What do you want us to do? Call the cops?" "Screw the cops. Call the papers. Call Entertainment Weekly. At least let's try to sell the shit that's already in the stores." Chad shook his head at the lifeless sprawl. "One album, selfish bastard." Unaware of himself, Chad wandered into Ian's house. Jay quit his shuffling. "That was... okay, he's upset, but that kind of language..." "Something about your star act offing himself does that to a man."
"I understand that. Nobody's happy when their act dies."
Marcus raised his head for the first time. His hands unfolded themselves, and one extended. Jay dug in his pocket, gave over his star tack.
"I'm not thrilled Ian's dead either, you know, but that doesn't give him the right to say..."
"To say what?" Marcus tossed off, uninterested and otherwise occupied, trying to recall a phone number. He remembered. He dialed.
I know he's upset."
Jay dribbled his words, trailed off into silence, picked up his shuffling at the exact point he left off. On the other end of a cell line, the party Marcus was calling picked up. "Yeah, hello? Let me have features." "Your damn cover story. That's what it's regarding." Inside Ian's house, Chad wandered. He looked at, without really seeing, the ornate fixtures, the art. All there was, everywhere he gazed, were things. So many things. Very expensive things. Why in the hell would Ian want to cut out when his life brimmed until it sloshed with so much stuff? As much stuff as Chad could ever conceive, and not just monetary things. Sure, Ian had durable goods by the busload, but he had the other stuff too. The unseen things that permeated the house with a thick aroma. The envy of people. The love of masses. And the lust of women. Most importantly, that. The endless variety of female delecti, mouth, ass, vagina, presented, given, gladly handed over in an equally endless march of shape, size, variety, and color. Ian had a stew of fame and notoriety to chow on day in and day out, but it did not satiate. It hadn't been enough for him. What does a man need to fill himself? What more did this man need that he didn't have? Or was it something else? A concept crawled spider-like through Chad's mind in the shadow of incomprehension. Maybe it wasn't that Ian wasn't full up. Maybe he was too full. Maybe he had completed himself to the point life was no longer worth or in need of living. But if it ain't fame and it ain't money and it ain't women, then what is it that completes a man? Across the room, a table. A space on the table. An emptiness that echoed of past occupation. A vacancy where, unknown to Chad, a dat player had but hours ago sat. In the void sang a siren song that called Chad, gravitated him toward it. From underfoot a sound, a light crunch. A knee-jerk brought Chad's foot up, and the same reaction brought his head down. From the floor, he picked up a name tag. 24/7 Mart, it said. Beneath that, Paris. Interior, video store, morning. The girl behind the counter was 19, and white trash, distilled to its purest form, uncontaminated, unaffected, undetrashified by the many and various, the endless variety of ethnicities in the city she'd migrated to, the city of Los Angeles, from whatever Walmartized portion of lower middle America she once called home. The girl was white trash by virtue of the pumps she wore with her Levi's and the halter top that drooped from her shoulders, exposing creamy pink, afraid of the sun flesh. She was white trash because of her hair, dirty blonde despite its bleaching, which had been teased and permed, blown out and curled. It had been everything, except properly introduced to a comb, or at least to a comb that was anything like familiar with current hairstyles. The store was open but empty, too early in the day for anyone to be renting videos. The girl filled her time in thumbing through a Hollywood fluff rag, not bothering with the simple-worded articles, but lingering in rapture over all the pictures of beautiful movie star people hanging out in beautiful movie star places, doing nothing more significant than looking good. Manufactured glamour shots were just about as heavy-duty a concept as this chick could handle. All the more she'd ever aspired to. Pure, white, trash. In fact, the only matter of substance that ever complicated her uncomplicated white trash mind was where to put her chewing gum while she fucked. At the moment, not even that germ of a thought was present. Enter parents. "Nickel around?" he asked. The girl didn't look up. She yelled to a room in the back of the store, hidden, not much and not well, behind curtains.
"Nickel Paris is here."
"He alone?" Nickel's bodiless voice questioned. This time the girl looked up, lifted her head. Lead it was made of, the way the effort seemed. A tired gaze at Paris, her head back down.
"Yeah,"
she hollered. "Nickel, send him back."
"Go on back."
"Thanks." Paris went off to find the man behind the curtain. In the back of the store was a room. In the room were rows of metal shelves. On the shelves were VCRs. Hooked up to each VCR, one next to another, forming an electric wall of moving images, were dozens of televisions playing the same grainy, shaky, more than slightly out of focus picture. At a table was a man. The man was Nickel. Nickel was kind of short and pretty much middle-aged in appearance. He might have been younger, but he was balding and overweight, and it was kinder to think of him as a typical middle-aged guy rather than a younger guy who didn't look so good. At his table, Nickel was very diligently affixing labels, Xerox down one sheets to cassette boxes. He looked like Baldy, the pituitary-impaired elf doing chores for Santa. Paris said, "Hey, Nickel." Nickel said, "Hey, man." A nod of his head toward the electric wall. "Just running off some new Spielbergs." "How'd you get that? It's still in the theaters." "Sent a kid in with a camcorder. Taped it off the screen."
"Off the screen?"
"Yeah. Except for when the kid laughs and jiggles the camera, it ain't too bad."
"It looks like shit,"
Paris differed. Nickel was the kind of guy where there was only a thimbleful of things he was defensive about. When you're overweight, balding, and spend your time in a cathode-lit back room, you're not much in a position to take life too personal. But this, what Nickel referred to as his trade, what the world called bootlegging, was his little illegal corner of the Empire Entertainment. He took his corner very seriously. "Hey," Nickel growled, angry displeasure squeezing out through narrow eyes. He stood for effect.
but coming off the stool to his feet only made him shorter.
You want it on DVD with THX surround sound? You can wait 18 months and pay $30. You want it first, you want it fast, you come to me.
He slapped another miniature one sheet crookedly onto a video box.
Now what can I do for you? Want Coppola's new flick?
Nickel jerked his head at some more TVs that were copying images of fuzzy blobs doing something up on the silver screen.
No, Paris said. No, I was looking to make a little cash.
You and the world, baby. What's the plan this week?
A tape. Can you move it for me?
What you got?
It's not video. Audio.
Music?
Nichols scratched at his face, fingernails catching on his acne scars. When you got it bad in the looks department, you got it bad all the way.
I don't bootleg tunes much anymore, but I could probably get it out. Anything good?
Ian Germain, that guy from Wish of Instant, whatever.
Nickel exhaled himself a scoffing laugh.
Aw, man. You crawling out of the woodwork with the rest of the slugs?
The rest?
Paris wasn't quite following.
Everybody's going to be trying to pass that shit off now. What do you got, a concert or something?
No, it's... Nobody's ever heard this.
What?
What do you mean, crawling out of the...
Nobody's ever heard what?
Paris and Nickel locked in a French kiss of miscommunication, transmitting confusion back and forth. Paris said,
I just figured it might be worth something. We copy up a few tapes, get it sold.
Wait, what are you talking about? What you said before, nobody's heard this.
It's new stuff. I got a new tape.
New?
Nickel sunk a little deeper into non-comprehension.
Yeah, new. He just made it. Like I said, nobody's heard it before. I figured we bootleg it. We can make a few hundred.
A video box, the tiny one sheet meant to adorn it seconds ago, slipped from Nickel's hand, his fingers having lost their grip, lost all normal sensation. Nickel had become preoccupied with a new and stronger feeling, one that came around with the stink of money. It was the tactile sense of greed.
A few hunt?
Nickel flustered out.
You're shitting me, right? You don't think we can get that much?
A beat. Disbelief at what he was hearing sat Nickel down. He got himself together for some explaining.
What are you doing, hibernating? You hiding out somewhere? He's dead.
What?
Ian Germain is dead.
The news flash hit like a wife beater and staggered Paris just the same.
Ian is dead. Yeah, you're getting it. Dead and gone. He killed himself.
When?
I don't know.
What time?
I don't know. What did I say? I said I don't know. It was just on the news. Jumped into a pile of shit or something. Weird.
I didn't think he'd really...
Jesus,
Paris gasped.
Jesus two times. Guy like that takes himself out. He isn't just another stiff, he's pure legend, know what I'm saying? Hendrix and Morrison and Joplin, Christ. Dying was the best thing that ever happened to John Denver.
And you've got Ian Germain's music. You've got something no one's heard. And you want to know if you can make a few hundred? Try it again. Try millions.
In breathless repetition.
Millions?
Nickel looked at Paris. Nickel looked at him. And as he did, the shadow of money lust eclipsing his face, Nickel changed. Slightly and subtly, barely to the naked eye, he morphed from being just a guy into a guy who wanted something from another guy, and wanted it with a voracity. It was an alteration you had to look for carefully, but once found, you knew was there. The change was hardly at all, but total and complete. Just that little, and just that much. The new nickel asked, "Where you got this tape?" The new nickel took a step toward Paris. A moment ago it would have been a step taken, just a step, and nothing more than that. But in the moment that had passed, the moment in which Nickel had become as unrecognizable as he was familiar, his soul alien snatched and avarice replaced B-movie style, the step he took was more like a haunting, threatening creep. Paris matched Nickel's move, but backward toward the door.
I don't.
You said,
I've got, I know someone who could get it. Let me talk to him.
Wait a minute, man.
I'm just going to talk to him.
Paris stumbled, made gimp by the disjuncture of thought and action. His mind was pondering a dat and a dead Ian and a word Nickel had said, millions. His body was concentrating on getting the hell out of the store. The result was a herky-jerky dance by Paris from the back room into the main room, a shelf knocked over along the way. Bootlegs of a shitty Hollywood movie, another shitty Hollywood movie, skittered across the floor. Nickel, his voice, chased Paris as he bolted outside and up the street.
Paris! Paris!
Then knowing what he'd just lost.
Damn!
Through all of that, Nickel with his yelling and Paris with his knocking things over, only once did the white trash girl with the perpetually dirty blonde hair look up from her magazine. A beat later, she went right back to the hardy business of doing nothing more than looking at all those pretty pictures. Pushing mid-morning. The sun was heading into round two of its daily struggle with the smog. Losing. Getting the crap kicked out of it. Getting beat down behind gray soot drapes that hung over the city and greenhoused it. It was going to be hot downtown. It was going to be killer in the valley. That's what the organism LA, 8.7 million strong, was gearing up for. The heat. How to deal with the heat. How to survive the heat until sundown. How to sleep through the hot night. How to handle the heat all over again tomorrow. What the organism LA wasn't much thinking about was abandoned cars under overpasses, or a particular car under a particular overpass Alf's body was half in, half out of. Omar and Kenny were thinking about it. The car, Alf's body. Its blood coagulated so that even it no longer moved and flowed in ersatz life.
That's the ride.
Kenny talking.
Huh? Like Martin described?
Omar nodded.
Held on just long enough to drop dime. One time in his life, he ever toughed anything out.
Nodding at the Continental.
Didn't get very far.
Omar walked to the body, gave it a close visual inspection. He knew well of the dead, having early on taken the clinic on shot-up bodies L.A. gives away daily to its urban youth.
Looks like they got him.
So motherfucking what?
Kenny talked loud and tough. He talked loud and tough when he was away from Damon, and even more so when he was around Omar. Omar was quiet and smart. He had stayed in school past the 10th grade. For around the way, he was a goddamn genius. Kenny couldn't compete with quiet and smart. He couldn't compete with Omar's non-fucked-up-by-bullet-to-the-throat voice, either. All he could do was make a lot of noise and be hard-ass about it, so no one would correct him on his dumbness.
He killed two of Damon's boys, his cuz, and ran off with Damon's shit. So what if they got him?
All I'm saying is they got him.
A foot sound and a wave of his hand to dismiss Omar's logicalizing.
They got his ass, but they didn't kill him. Not right off. Don't mean shit if they don't kill somebody. This ain't no motherfucking game of tag and shit. We ain't in the get motherfuckers business. We in the get motherfuckers dead business.
They couldn't have known they were gonna get hit. That was a last minute drop. Whoever jacked Martin and them was small time, nickel and dime, trying to take Martin for whatever little bit he was holding. Bet they don't even know what they got.
That ain't the point. Them motherfuckers Damon sent fucked up. You dropping drugs from your boss to one of his dealers, you best be expecting shit. Have your gats ready to get to capping.
Omar lectured like he was giving a weekend seminar at the Ramada on gangbanging. Using his patented loud and tough style, he lectured more.
That's your motherfucking job. Protect the motherfucking drugs. You gotta be expecting shit. Any motherfucker on the street can walk around and not expecting shit. What we do, shit got to be expected.
Omar continued his analysis of the crime scene, surveying the car.
Bled all up in the back seat. Somebody drove him here.
Then somebody be a dead motherfucker. Stole Damon's shit. Damon gonna have a serious mad on.
Getting all quiet and solemn, Omar looked around, saw the graffitied walls of the underpass, the abandoned cars, the dead dog and its convention of flies. He closed his eyes and other things became apparent to him.
Trouble's coming, bro. It's all around. I can smell it like a summer storm.
Yeah, trouble's coming. And it's gonna rain vengeance.
Kenny, loud, tough.
Whatever.
The early edition of the LA Times was late enough that it had a piece on the short life, questionable significance, and bizarre death of Ian Germain. Paris got himself a copy, quarter tossed to the newsie who worked the stand along Cahuenga. Paris whipped through the article, his brain feeding only on the words it needed. Dead. Manure. Agent. Chad Bayless. Continental Talent Agency. After that, the paper wasn't good for nothing but tossing. Ideas, big ideas, thrashed in Paris's puddle of a mind. Ideas born of one word from Nickel.
Millions.
Driven by the word, his every other instinct faded away, until one remained. Do this. Do this for her. End of the street. A payphone. Paris went for it, digging change from his pocket. Chad's teeth worked at a thumbnail. Bit it, whittled it, shaped it in a thoughtless way. He had canceled all meetings and shunned the inevitable calls from Variety and the reporter so that he could spend the morning with himself. 10 minutes of his own company reminded Chad he was the last person in the world he wanted to be alone with. 11 minutes into his retreat, he found out that the thumbnail thing was just enough activity to keep him from going completely bonkers. The intercom buzzed, police siren loud, and Chad gave a frightened start, same as if it was. Smacking at the phone with his fist, the whole plastic unit skipped across his desk like a slap puppy.
Chad?
His secretary, Jen, her voice coming through the speaker.
What?
Chad?
Chad's fingers punched futilely at the buttons on the phone, trying to make the intercom work. Mind numb, he was useless with himself. A retard tried to type Shakespeare.
What?
Hello? Chad?
Yelling.
What?
Screaming.
What?
Jen heard him, through the door, not through the phone.
There's a Paris on 234 for you?
Paris. Paris who?
He didn't give a last name. He told me to tell you he has the last of Ian. Doesn't that seem an odd thing to say? The last of Ian? I'll tell you what I think. You want to know what I think?
Jen went on with theories about how Paris probably worked for the Globe or the Star, or worse yet, People magazine, and was trying to trick Chad into an interview. Maybe, though, she considered, because of this last of Ian remark, Paris might be either an obsessed fan or Ian's gay lover, because she was always convinced that Ian was gay, regardless of the statutory rape charges that were... Chad heard zero of that. His secretary was just verbal muzak. Paris, he mouthed. He mouthed it again. Paris. Realization hit. Hands all over himself. The name tag. Found it. The pin bit into his finger as he pulled it from a pocket. The name. Paris. Put him through.
What? Hello?
Put him through the goddamn phone!
That Jen got.
Hello?
A voice came across the speaker. Male this time. Chad fumbled up the receiver.
Hello? You Chad Bayless?
Yes, and you're Paris?
Yeah.
Some quiet. Some labored and nervous breathing got mixed together over fiber optics. Across the way from Paris, on the other side of the street, a guy and a woman were talking. Just standing, talking. Then the guy pulled a gun from his pocket. Real casually, he pulled it out. Showed it to the woman. No different than if he were showing her a watch on a fob. He didn't do anything with it, except show it to her. And Paris couldn't tell if he was showing it to her to scare the woman. Impress her. Maybe he was just showing it to her... to show it to her. Showing it to her as if to say, hey, you know how everyone else in the city is a piece? I got one too. After that, the guy put the gun back in his pocket, and him and the woman walked on. Chad asked,
how are you, Paris?
Okay.
Good, that's good.
Sweat sandpaper scraped its way down Chad's temple, and simultaneously across town, didn't flow much easier over Paris's flesh. At this moment in the entire world, were there two more desperate men, or would a more desperate man already be watching the hammer fall on the gun in his mouth?
Well, Paris, is there something you'd like to talk about, or did you just want to breathe at me?
Chad was getting his bullshit cool back. He had the advantage. He knew how to work a phone. It's what being an agent was all about. That and all the backstabbing and ass-fucking 10% could buy. Play things nice and easy. See what the boys got to say, Chad thought. The first clear one he'd had in a while. See what this Paris is all about.
I've got the last of Ian.
Paris talked like words were new to him, halting and unsure.
That's what you told my secretary, the last of Ian. What does that mean?
I've got his last tape. I've got the last songs he ever sung.
What do you mean, his last?
Riding on a lava of frustration.
What are you, stupid? He's dead, man. And I've got the last stuff he ever did.
The last songs Ian Germain ever recorded are on sale at Tower Records. I don't know who you think you're scamming.
To the mouthpiece of the phone, Paris put the DAT machine, the play button, depressed. After a short while, Paris turned the tape off again. In the wake of the music, against himself, against his own inability to articulate the experience, Chad managed one word.
Wow.
It was Ian. It was his music and more. It was glory. It was the sound the heavenly host made with nothing more than the non-effort of opening their mouths. It was all that, and Chad knew, with a short-form video running in heavy rotation on MTV, it would ship at nearly 4 million units in its first pressing.
Well, where did you get... I got it. Where did you... I got it, okay?
Chad's bullshit cool was burned up, which is what happens to bullshit cool when things get complicated. It was Paris as much as anybody who was handling business now.
I got the tape. That's all you need to know. Yeah, all right, fine. You got it.
More sweat from Chad. It ran faster over his face, cut deeper. He talked things up as sweet as he could. We're all friends here, his tone said. So let's just be reasonable, and don't nobody panic. His thoughts got sharp with himself. Especially you, Bayless. Don't panic. As non-panicky as possible.
And I'm glad that you called me, Paris. It's a good thing that you called. Now, why don't you just bring the tape in here, to my office, and give it to me, and maybe... How about, for being such a good guy, we can get you a few CDs? Would you like that, Paris? Would you like some CDs?
Keep it together, Chad, baby. Keep it all together.
Just a way of saying thank you. Thank you for being on the ball.
Paris was a man without a plan. The tape he'd stumbled into possessing, and having sense enough to call the agent of the dead guy he'd gotten it from, is where what little smarts he had quit him. From there forward, Paris was doing just-in-time manufacturing of ideas only milliseconds before they spilled from his mouth.
I want $1 million.
That was a good number, right? Nice and round and big.
Excuse me? For the tape, I want $1 million. You're out of your mind. It's worth that much. $1 million? It's worth more than that.
And it probably was. He should have done his strategizing before he dialed up Chan, Paris thought. He should have asked for more dough.
So what, how much it's worth? You think I've got a bucket of cash sitting around here?
Maybe, maybe not. Didn't matter to Paris.
I want my money. I don't have $1 million. Chad Banshee screamed.
Paris just got high off of it, making some dude he didn't know crazy. It was power he was feeling. First tastes free. Chad.
Do you know what you're asking? That's not possible, okay? $1 million is not possible. Now, let's just be cool and talk. There's nothing to talk about. Where am I supposed to get that kind of money? You know so much, where?
Paris didn't know where, but he knew Chad could get it. He read magazines, watched the infotainment shows. They were always going on about rock stars and record guys, and how they got this and that, drugs and chicks and bowls of M&Ms with all the yellow ones taken out, how they were always living fast and high and hard, money flowing like blood from a bullet-shot heart. $1 million? That was change. That was the dough they used to tip the bathroom attendant, or last night's whore. $1 million? That was nothing for a tape from a freshly dead legend, and a good tape at that. Chad didn't know how easy he was getting let off. Paris.
Where you get it from's not my problem. All I know is, I don't get the million, you don't get the tape. And cash, too. No check bullshit. What do you say?
Time was audible. It clicked heavy in its passing. Seconds. A metronome for Chad to build up his rhythm before he cut loose, furious to the beat.
What do I say? I say you're a little cock-sucking son of a bitch, that's what I say. Think you can call me up and squeeze me for cash? Is that what you think?
The rage was real, but driven by impotence. A man slapping a woman because he can't stay hard.
Slapping on. You don't know who you're dealing with.
Spittle flew from Chad's mouth and lodged in the receiver.
I'll cut your little son of a bitch heart out and fuck you in the hole. So you listen to me, you shit. I'm gonna get my tape.
I'm gonna get you, I'm gonna get my tape, then I'm gonna put my foot on your throat and twist. You hear that? You hear that sound? That's your neck snapping.
Sucking hard on the pipe of control. Guess you're gonna need some time to think about this. I'll be in touch. Paris hung up the phone. The world was a better place. Looked better from his platform of mastery. From way up there, Paris got a real nice view of the people ants and duty bugs. The very things both moments and a lifetime ago he used to be himself. An insignificant mite that scurried from dropping to dropping, surviving on the scraps left by the movers and the shakers, the doers and high livers, the people who see life and grab onto it until fingers strike bone. The people who get shit done. A phone call. Just one phone call. And now Paris was one of them. Almost. Would be with the cash he was about to collect. Paris would be $1 million worth of somebody. How do you like that? He said to Ian. Said in a spiteful prayer that he willed out through time and space and dimension to wherever it was grungy white guys who had suicided themselves went. How do you like that? You're dead in a heap of crap and I'm here. Here with your music that I never gave a damn about before. And it's gonna do things for me. Put a wad in my pocket, make me a man. It's going to buy her back. Who's the loser now? Paris prayed. Fuck you, was his amen. The click, the dial tone, a train wreck in Chad's ear. Then there was nothing. Then fear and panic and more fumbling at the phone.